for the most entertaining talk anywhere. Stay tuned to LA Talk Radio, your real talk station. Your real 24 hours of commercial-free programming.
You're listening to Critical Mass with Rick Franzi and Doug Feller. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Good afternoon on this August 31st, the last day of August 2009. This is Rick Franzi. I will be your host today for the 35th installment of Critical Mass, the radio show. And I'd just like to make sure that our very special guest today, Dave Prezio, is online. Dave, are you online?
Yes, I sure am.
Okay, great. I'll be right back in a minute, Dave. Just wanted to take care of a couple of housekeeping things here for our listening audience. As I said, this is the 35th installment of the Critical Mass radio show. During that time, which started, as you know, back in March of 2009, we have interviewed, well, Dave will be our 49th business owner, top executive here in Orange County. Doug's my business partner, we've been co-hosting this show, which airs on Monday and Tuesday afternoons. Our goal with this show is to help business owners and top executives make better, more informed decisions by interviewing thought leaders and executives who have what we call transferable knowledge, ideas, and experiences. Our radio show is an extension of our 15-year business practice where we build executive forums for top executives in Orange County, California, and we do this under the brand Renaissance Executive Forums. Doug and I are currently leading multiple CEO peer groups here in Orange County, California. Our research shows that 80% of the issues and opportunities that a top executive faces are common with other top executives who are leading similarly sized firms. Last year, actually, it's a year ago, September, I published the book Critical Mass, which was featured in an article written by Jan Norman in the Orange County Register earlier this year. And the book has been called The Definitive Guide to the CEO Peer Group Experience. For those of you that are interested, it's available for sale on Amazon.com. If you'd like to learn more about the executive forums practice, I would encourage you to check out our website. There's a lot of information on the different forums, the radio show, online advice community, as well as other information that's designed to help business owners make better, more informed decisions. To find it, all you have to do is go to Critical Mass for, that's spelled F-O-R, business. So if you type in criticalmassforbusiness.com, you'll be right on our website. Okay. Well, as I said, I'm very excited to have our guest today, Dave Prezio. Dave is and has been with Prezio Construction for some time, 1975, but his firm has been in business, and it was started by his grandfather in 1942. I'm excited to have David on our show today because he has led his firm through a number of recessions and has a great perspective on what needs to be done to maintain a business during a challenging time. Not unlike what we're facing here for the past year or so. So the topic's going to be how his firm is addressing the challenges and opportunities within the building industry here in Orange County. So Dave, I guess I'd like to start off by asking you if you could tell our audience about, you know, your path to Prezio Construction.
Well, I started working for the company in high school, after school, summers, basically grew up in the company. Went to college, started off pursuing civil engineering, anticipating going into the business, and then changed my mind, decided I wanted to do something else, and then changed it back again because the opportunity just seemed too good to not take advantage of. So I finally got through my 4 years of college after 6 years of a rather tortured path. And it's funny, my son is doing exactly the same thing. That is, taking 6 years to get through school.
Well, maybe the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, does it, sometimes?
Yeah. Anyway, I joined the firm full-time in 1975. Started working, doing engineering for Tilt-Up Construction and estimating, project management, and just grew with the company. Worked with my father to expand the business, and ultimately ended up taking over day-to-day management of the company 10 years later, 1985.
Okay. Could you, you sort of mentioned in there a bit about what the firm does, but could you help our audience to understand more about Prezio Construction by giving us more details on your area and what part of the market you're serving?
Our firm focuses on doing structural concrete work primarily as a subcontractor for, in other words, we do a portion of the work, the concrete portion, for other general contractors. We do a lot of tilt-up, which is a type of construction especially well-suited to industrial buildings and warehouses, but we've also used it in retail and office buildings. In addition to tilt-up, we do a lot of foundation work and concrete decks for institutional-type projects, schools, government buildings, things like that. So the main focus, they say, is on structural concrete work of various types.
And the geographic market that your firm serves?
We primarily serve Southern California, although we have worked in a number of other states. Done a lot of work in Oregon. We had a heavy involvement in Texas for some time. That'd be primarily. So, but the main focus is Southern California, but we go wherever our customers want us to go, basically.
Listening to, thinking about doing business as far away as Texas from Southern California or even up north in Oregon, different state, probably kind of different regulations. In your experience, Dave, when you follow your customer to those kind of distant locations, how much does that sort of change your business as far as, how you handle the business? Does it affect it at all? Is it different putting in, work in Texas versus doing it in San Clemente, let's say?
I think when you go out of state, the thing that becomes the most difficult is communication, because you're just physically removed. So instead of being able to go out to a job site in an hour or two, it's much more involved. So I end up seeing the jobs less, and I become more reliant on the people that we send out there. So having key people that you can trust who can work with minimal supervision becomes extremely important. As far as it's working in the different states, there's a lot of, joking around about how it is to deal with, people in Texas or we've heard the stories about how the people in Oregon hate people in California. Mm-hmm. And we by and large found that not to be the case, that when we've gone out of state, people have been friendly, generally easy to work with. If you treat them well, they treat you well. And like I say, it's been mostly a good experience as long as you have the key people there who can take responsibility, people that you can rely on. So people that will make sure that they ask questions when they need to kind of shore up those lines of communication that are always a little more difficult when you're that far away.
Yeah, that's interesting because we, coincidentally, Doug and I, we were having lunch today with a business owner who's leading a growing business here in Orange County, and he and his partner are planning expansion. They've expanded into the LA market, and now they're looking into several other markets across the country. Similar types of issues, then that's sort of what we were talking to him about is the span of control changes a little bit. You're not in the office. You have to trust that the culture that you have in your main location and the work is being done the same way. So different industry, very different industry from what you're in, not in the construction business, but probably many of the same issues and opportunities that you faced in the past, he's going to be facing moving forward. So,
yeah, I'm sure that long distance communication is a problem that everybody's going to have as they move to, distant areas. And I think that I'm sure it's not unique to our business by any means.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the questions that we'd like to ask each of our guests, and we're always fascinated by the response and listening to the answer. So the question I'd like to ask you really relates to your particular experience, Dave, and kind of key lessons learned that you've learned through, you know, successfully leading your firm since the 70s and 80s. So would you share with our audience kind of a key lesson learned or two from your experience?
Yeah, I think the thing that was probably the hardest for me to learn, but the most important thing to learn is that sales and profits are not the same thing. It's, for some reason, construction, and I'm probably not unique to this business, but there's a lot of focus on sales. Everybody wants to be bigger, do more business than the other guy. But what we found over the years is that really that focus is misplaced. The thing that's important is to make sure that you make money at what you do. And if you can get, you know, if you can make a lot of money on a small amount of work, that's a whole lot better than making hardly any money on a whole bunch of work.
That's good advice.
Yeah, so my philosophy is you go out and get profitable work, and then you need to adjust your overhead to match the volume of good work that you can find, rather than committing yourself to a lot of overhead and then going out and chasing sales, many of which may have a low or no profit margin. And it seems, I guess, it seems obvious when we're talking about it, but it's a lot of people get caught up in the idea that somehow if they could just be a little bit bigger, mm-hmm. that would somehow solve the problems they have of the overhead that they've acquired or whatever, and it's found that really didn't work out.
That's a very powerful insight, because in our experience as well, working with business owners, there seems to be a belief that the next major revenue level will really make things a bit easier. And if that's $1 million company, it's, you know, okay, if I get to 2.5 million, if it's 2.5, it's 5, you know, if it's 5, it's 10. But to your point, two challenges. One, growing profitably can be a challenge, because many times your expenses are in front of your revenue, right? You have to put money into the business to be able to grow to that level. And sometimes it's a disproportionate amount of expenses that actually, to your point, maybe lowers your net income, even for the additional revenue. More costs come into your business than anticipated. And so that the price quality, if you will, of the incremental revenue isn't the same as it was when you were smaller. Can you think of, in the construction industry or in for your companies, do you have an example of maybe where, you know, you've seen, you know, large revenue but little profit?
Well, we see it all the time. One year that was a particularly rough year for a lot of construction companies. There was a huge company that had reported something like $4 billion in sales, and they made a net profit of $1 million. $1 million is a lot of money, especially to a small businessman, but if you can imagine the risk that goes with $4 billion worth of work, and to walk away from that with $1 million to show for it is, it's laughable. I think what happens is if you focus on volume, you end up chasing customers that are just not going to be good customers for you. Either mm-hmm. they're people who are just, for whatever reason, not going to allow you to make money, or they're people who are doing kinds of work that you're maybe not as good at as you could be. And so you talk yourself into taking on, you know, a lot of risk and a expenditure of a great deal of effort and end up with not much to show for it except a lot of work and a lot of risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thinking back on your example of $4 billion in revenue and $1 million in profit, you almost wonder how they knew they made $1 million on that much revenue. A couple, yeah. You know, timing issues of costs or something, and, you know, could either make you make $1 million or not make $1 million, you know?
Yeah, it sounds like the rounding error on $4 billion, doesn't it?
Yeah, we got to make something. Put $1 million down there.
Well, it may have come down to that. You know, the accountants may have gotten together and said, you know, we got to show something. I have no idea if they did.
Yeah, I don't either.
Those things do happen. You know, they might have juggled a few expenses around and said, yeah, we made a profit.
Yay. We didn't lose money. Yeah. I guess I'd like to shift a little bit to a conversation that you and I and Doug had about how you're, you know, continuing to look for business that fits your business model, but maybe is in, you know, different a different way, let's say. And you talked about your efforts to capitalize on, I'll say, perceived opportunity within the federal stimulus funding for shovel-ready programs. Can you help our audience understand from your perspective in your industry, you know, kind of how you see that as an opportunity and what you're doing about it?
You know, the shovel ready has become a bit of a joke in our industry. Our opinion is that the only thing that was shovel ready was the baloney coming out of Washington, D.C.
I wondered what you were going to say there when you were saying that, but thank you for saying baloney.
Yeah, in an unguarded moment, I might have picked different words.
I understand.
But I think everybody knows what I'm talking about. I mean, the problem is that shovel-ready construction projects would be limited to things like patching potholes or maybe putting in a handicap access ramp at your local intersection. I mean, these are the kind of things that are shovel-ready. They're small, and they're just not a lot of money. If you're doing anything that's significant, there ain't no such thing as shovel-ready. I mean, you have a lot of work to do to get ready for a major construction project, a lot of approvals, a lot of people to satisfy, a lot of things to deal with. And so it's become a joke, really. There's almost no shovel-ready work. And the work that we've been pursuing, which is mostly Department of Defense work, is at best will be starting next year, and some of the things that we're looking at are not even expected to start till 2012. So, you know, the short-term stimulative effect of that is pretty close to zero.
You had mentioned, though, even though it's not an immediate in the term, and the term shovel-ready is a misnomer, you do believe that relative to some military bases, et cetera, that you do see over time a genuine opportunity in construction for those type of facilities. Is that correct?
There apparently has been a large commitment of funds to projects on military bases in Southern California, Camp Pendleton, Miramar, Coronado Island, some of these places, a lot of barracks, recreation facilities, things like that. Because there are just a lot of proposals that are out there, a lot of requests for proposal that are being sent out. So there's no doubt that there will be a lot of work in the not too distant future, and that seems to be at least for somebody in construction that's oriented towards buildings rather than say highways or dams and waterways, something like that, which are really outside of what we do. For somebody to focus on buildings, it looks like there is going to be a fair bit of building going on, but it's, again, the problem is it just takes a while to get it going.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, please, go ahead.
I think compared to the other sectors that we normally pursue, which would be private work or public work that's not federal, say state work, schools, such the federal work seems to be where the most money is flowing, going to be flowing in the next couple of years.
So with your experience with state and private work, I mean, what have you learned or what are you learning through this effort of focusing a little bit on the federal work?
Well, everything with the federal government seems to be more complex and more drawn out and more detailed and more paperwork. The proposal process are much more involved. From what you've been able to tell from our research, the actual execution of the work is subject to more scrutiny and involves a lot more paperwork, a lot more backup for everything you do. For instance, on a state-funded school job, if you have something that gets changed in the plans, you put together a change order, and you'd have a certain amount of backup that would go with that, showing what your costs are going to be. But for the in the federal work, the level of detail that would have to go into that is much more, and then their ability to go back and audit your expenses for this work that you did is much more extensive than what you see, what we normally see on a, say, a state-funded project. So it's just more complicated.
And generally, when I hear that, I think expense, right? Because that that complexity comes with an associated effort and time and people and money. And so when you bid those jobs, you're going to have to go into that with your eyes open then. Or, as we talked earlier, you run the risk of having a lower return on the revenue that you get.
Yes, we estimate that on a typical job that we would have one additional body, one person that would be dedicated just to meeting federal requirements for paperwork on that project. Would this be one more than we would normally have on, say, a state-funded job?
Mm.
So then that would be basically full time for that person during the project. That's all they would be doing.
Mm-hmm. And that's important to have identified that going into it, because if you don't, and then you bid the job and you win it, and then you realize you need this extra person, it's just going to come out of, it's very unlikely you're going to be able to get any additional funds to do the work, right?
You're just going to have that from profit.
Right? Yeah, you just got to suck it up and chalk it up to one of those lessons learned.
Right, it's called buying an education.
Which is part of why Doug and I do this show and have people like you on it, because hopefully people that are listening, and maybe they're not in construction, but they're thinking the same thing. I know that we have members who are working towards getting more federal government work. Here's a lesson learned, because if it's true in your industry, it's more than likely true in other industries as well. So, you know, one of the things that you had mentioned was the importance of a bonding company. Could you explain that a little bit for as that relates to your industry? Would you explain that a little bit, Dave?
Yeah, in construction, most work that's done for a government entity would require the contractor to not only guarantee that they're going to do the work themselves, but then to hire an outside company, a company called Assurity, who would then give a guarantee of their own that we would do the work. So it's sort of like an insurance policy on our performance. So if we don't do the work, if we go broke, if we abandon the job, whatever, then this bonding company would step in and hire somebody to finish the job. And of course, that costs money.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay a premium for that, 1 or 2% of the contract amount, depending on the size of the job. And this company then would back that up. Typically required on these public kind of jobs. And so you can imagine that if the bonding company is going to guarantee that we are going to complete the job, then they're very interested in our ability to do that. So they want to look at our financial statements, our relationship with our banker, our past performance on similar types of jobs. And so they're monitoring that on a regular basis. Every month they want to see a financial statement. And two or three times a year, they come out in person, talk to us, talk to customers, make sure things are going well, stay comfortable with us. Or if not, then we're going to have a hard time getting them to write a bond for us. So that's a whole, besides our banking relationship, then that becomes another financial type relationship that's that has to be nurtured.
Which takes time.
Yeah, it's part of being in business.
All right. You had also mentioned an aspect of preserving cash as an element of working with a bonding company in this environment as well?
Yes, bonding companies feel very strongly that having lots of cash is the best assurance that they can get that you'll be able to solve whatever trouble you get into, which is a pretty good theory. You know, people, mm-hmm. if people have cash, they can solve problems, and if they don't have cash, then they can't. That's pretty clear cut. So the bond company is always very concerned about how much, what's our working capital compared to the amount of work we're doing,
mm-hmm.
and compared to the amount of work that we want to bond. So they have ratios. You know, if you have so many dollars in the bank, then you can do a certain multiple of that in business, and they're still comfortable with that. And so they're always looking at things that how much cash you have, what are the threats to that level of cash? Are you, you know, am I taking money out of the company? Am I losing money on another job? All these things that potentially impact cash, they're very interested in. And for good reason. I mean, basically, if you have cash, you can keep going. And if you run out of cash, you are broke. Even though you may have assets, if you don't have
right.
money, you're basically functionally broke. They know that.
I think one of the other meetings we had, I think you said that you're not out of business or something as long as you have cash, right? But
right, you're not
you're
out
right.
of business if you have cash, but if you right. are out of cash, you're out of business.
I don't care how beautiful the office is. Yeah.
That's right. Nobody yeah. cares.
Nobody
you
cares.
You make payroll with that. That's what they want to know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
if
great.
If you're sitting here on Tuesday wondering how you're going to cover your payroll checks on Friday, having a wonderful office building somewhere is of no value.
Look at the paintings, though, and the environment
right.
that you get. Yeah. It's air-conditioned. All right. Well, that was fun. That was a good conversation. I'd like to shift gears here a little bit in that your business was started in 1942. I mean,
yes.
Man, the changes in the Southern California marketplace. You have the life expectancy for the business to be around at least 75 years in total, and if not, you know, longer than that. I mean, but as you look at future generations and the future of your business, I mean, how do you feel about the possibility, at least, that your business, your venerable business, may have an end of life at some point here in the future?
Yeah, I'm glad. On the one hand, I'm glad my kids have enough sense to go do something else. But I say that half in jest anyway. But on the other hand, it's a kind of a sad thing to contemplate, just closing the doors for the last time and going home and knowing that's the end of it. So that's something that's not terribly far distant in my future. And so it's, you know, something I'm definitely thinking about.
Well, you used the term, if I remember correctly, you know, that maybe the last recession, the building slowed down, and it was sort of felt like you went through a meat grinder. I mean, I think business owners and top executives who are listening to this show can identify with that feeling that, you know, during some of the very tough times, you're just, you know, it takes all you have to kind of keep the focus on the business and staying with it. So, and having been in business and been personally leading your company for as long as you have, you've probably been through several recessionary cycles that are, I'm sure, taxing on you as the president, right? I mean,
yeah, very much so. I mean, we've been through a number of small recessions in this last, say, 24 years that I've been in charge. But we had a similar situation to this back in the early 90s, where we had a major collapse of the savings and loan industry and a drying up of credit for commercial construction, for basically all construction for some time. And it took quite a while to get through that. So, that was the first big one, so to speak, that I'd been through and definitely made some mistakes. In how I handled that and came very close to being, you know, wiped out. But luckily we got some good work right before we ran out of money. and, you know, we're able to turn things around. But that's where I really came to understand the importance of having cash and preserving cash as things tighten up. And it's a tough place to be in because on the one hand, you're not really sure how bad and how long things are going to go. And you don't want to absolutely wipe out your company. I mean, you have key people that have important knowledge and skills that you want to preserve because you know you can't do work without these people. And of course, many of these people, you have, you know, warm personal relationships with. They've been with us for a long time. And so it gets very difficult to make these tough choices about, you know, who stays and who doesn't and when they go. And, you know, and so I think you're always tending to hang on to people. You know, in a bad recession, you always tend to hang on to people longer than you should and probably trying to be more optimistic than you should. And it's, even though, even having been through it once before, like say this time, it's the same basic problem. I mean, you know that there's tough things you got to do, and you got to, the sooner you do them, the better it is, the more cash you'll keep. But again, it's, you have imperfect knowledge of the future, so you're always hopeful that, well, it'll turn around pretty soon. But like this time, it looks kind of like it's going to be like the early 90s, and it's not going to turn around pretty soon. So you just have to recalibrate, you know, the amount of work that you think you're going to do and adjust your staff, you know, to accommodate what's available and not burn through all your cash based on wishful thinking.
Yeah, I'd like to kind of reinforce that point because, you know, we have been talking about conserving cash so that, you know, you can continue to stay in business. And, you know, during good times, maybe that means putting off an acquisition of new office furniture or something. But during tough recessionary times, many times that concept of conserving cash really comes down to people and how big of a payroll do you think you can successfully manage through the slowdown, right? I mean, that's a big consumer of cash.
I think that the big killers of cash are debt and payroll. And so I think, you know, you try to be prudent about debt and not take on too much of it, because even though debt's your friend when things are on the upswing, it's definitely your enemy when they're on the downswing. And sometimes it's hard to get rid of it. And then people, of course, is the other big cost that you can do something about. So it's a tough. I mean, when we just talk about it in this sort of hypothetical terms, it sounds like it's pretty straightforward. But it's, you know, having been through it, you know, it's very tough after say the first round of cuts or so that, you know, to make these decisions and to let people go. It's very tough.
Well, and if I recall correctly, you some of your employees have been with the firm for 15 years or longer.
Yes.
So
yeah, and it's really hard to let people go that have been with you for a long time, and especially in an environment where you know that they can't go down the street and find another job with somebody else. In good times, you don't like to, nobody ever likes to lay anybody off, but in good times, you know that if you had to lay somebody off, they can go find a job somewhere else, you know, usually in a few months, but not today. So I know if I cut somebody loose now, I know that they may be sitting at home on unemployment for 6 months, maybe more. And that's, you know, it's something that you hate to be the cause of that.
And that is, there are no universal truths, but I can say with great confidence that a large majority of business owners in Orange County that I deal with take the people aspect of their firm to heart very seriously and are very reluctant to reduce their payroll and their people because they know how valuable those people are. As well as you said, the ramifications of possibly having to put somebody on the streets.
It's always a combination of self-interest and an emotional attachment to people. if it was merely self-interest, it would be easier. Wouldn't necessarily be easy because you're still not exactly sure who you need for how long and when and all this. But then there's always the personal side too. It's very difficult. You know, even though capitalists are supposed to be, you know, heartless people, I haven't met very many of those kinds of capitalists, so I don't know where they are. But everybody, every business owner I know says the hardest thing they have to do is to let somebody go.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you, and I think that is a transferable feeling within the county. I'd like to, since you've been in the building industry for quite some time, your firm's been in since 42, you've been leading a construction firm for the past 24 years. Can you give our audience your perception for the building industry in Orange County?
As far as where it's heading in the short term? Or?
Yeah. You've kind of touched on some of it, but
it's
been a little bit.
It's not heading anywhere right now. I guess to give a little more detail to that, what we're seeing right now is an acute shortage of available capital for businesses to borrow. Basically, banks are making what they would call fairly low risk loans, FHA conforming loans on houses, and that's kind of about it. You know, I mean. Business owners are seeing credit lines pulled in. Mm-hmm. Commercial real estate loans are hard to come by, and commercial loans for business lines, you know, just to expand whatever, very hard to come by. And so this shortage of capital is basically shutting people off. So private businesses are just not doing much, especially when you combine that with the fact that everybody's nervous about, you know, whether or not they're going to still have customers, you know, 6 days, 6 months, 6 years from now. And so between the banks basically locking the doors and the business owners being nervous, private construction is just about stone cold dead. State work is, you know, in this state we have this interesting budget situation where we think we're probably broke, but we're not quite ready to admit it, and we keep fumbling around and keeping the doors open, so to speak. But that's had a real negative effect on public works that relies on state funding, and indirectly then on city funding, because the state has sort of borrowed a lot of money from cities, even though sometimes the cities didn't want to loan it to them. So there's a lot of uncertainty about the availability of capital within this state to do state-funded projects. Now, there's certain bond money that has been acquired in the past and is still being used for certain kinds of projects, but going forward, the money for state-funded projects is a little shaky. And then we have the federal work for which vast sums of money have been allocated, but they're having a lot of problems getting that money out the door. I guess nobody told them that it's one thing to approve $800 billion worth of spending, and it's a whole other matter to staff up for it, get the people in place to do it, process the paperwork, let the contracts. And now they're sort of choking on that execution part of the deal, where they have these good intentions, but they're unable to turn them into anything tangible because it's just a whole lot of work to spend $800 billion. And so that's kind of the main segments of construction where they are. I mean, from the commercial mm-hmm. side, we can look at the residential side, and there's a flicker of life there, but it's pretty slow, mainly because people are uncertain about their jobs. I think there is money available for mortgages, but people who are not sure if they have a job or people who are out of a job, you know, they're slow to commit on these things. So that market is alive, but very small. So that's
good. Well, and as we talked, Orange County is the economy in Orange County is interesting, but it is heavily dependent on small businesses.
Yeah, Orange County is really about small business. It's not like Detroit that depends on the big automakers or any of a number of other major cities that have a huge employer or a group of huge employers. Orange County's always been about small business, which I think has been a strength. It's been a very dynamic place because of that. But small businesses are having a hard time right now.
Okay, so let's fast forward to some date in the future when the building industry comes back. Do you think it'll be back to what it was, or do you have any feel for what it's going to look like when it is back and robust again?
Well, there will be more construction. It will be better. It always is. Orange County is transforming, though, because it's maturing. 30 years ago, we had a lot of open space in Orange County, and you could go out and get land, build buildings, and then go out and get more land and build more buildings, and that was a lot of people were doing that. Now Orange County is filling up. There's not a whole lot of empty land available for development. So the kinds of work we see now are different. We're tearing down old buildings. We're going back and doing infills, maybe lots that didn't get developed here and there, things like that, remodeling, things like this. So transforming buildings into new uses, or like I say, in many cases, just knocking them down and starting over again. So the kind of thing and the kind of industries we see in Orange County are changing too. We used to have a lot of small manufacturing in Orange County, a lot of machine shops, things like that. And we still have some of that, but not as much as we used to. So we see more demand for research and development and office, more sort of paper businesses rather than, go out and make things, kind of businesses. And so the different people need different types of buildings. So the face of construction in Orange County is changing just because of that. But it will come back. I mean, there will be work. It's just we don't know exactly when.
And to your point, it will be different than, because I'm sure, in the 24 years you've seen, in the cycles that you've seen, it keeps evolving and, as you said, maturing, but it keeps reinventing itself because people need new buildings. People like, when they have the money, if they can, they'd rather, I'm sure, tear down a place and put up something that maybe has more green technology in it or it is more modern in some, beyond the aesthetic point of view, more modern in how it's, interfaces with the environment and et cetera. So,
we're seeing a big push now to make buildings more energy efficient. So that's going to require modifications. Also, as you move from a manufacturing employee to a more of a service type of employee, those people have different expectations about what they need in a building. As women make up a larger percentage of the workforce, they, things like child care on site, some of these things like this emerge, and of course they need different kinds of buildings. If we switch over to the public side and look at, say, the community colleges, I mean, they're educating more and more adults. And so the kinds of facilities they need to do that are somewhat different than, the 19, 20, 21-year-olds that at one time made up the vast majority of community college students. And so all these things, there's these transitions. The transition is not really related to the economic problems we have right now. I mean, the short-term thing, it's more of a long-term trend of just, life in Orange County is changing, mm-hmm. maturing, kind of moving to, you know, different way of doing business.
This has been an interesting interview, and I appreciate your understanding of the market and your sharing of what you know. I guess I got to ask you, Dave, is there anything else about you or your firm that, you know, we've not talked about or that I didn't think to ask you that you'd like to mention to our audience in the time that we have left?
If you need a building built, give me a call.
Okay, which, that's fair.
I don't mean to be silly, but, you know, obviously we're like everybody else in our business. We're anxious to meet the needs of customers, wherever they may be.
So, if someone wanted to learn more about you and your firm, Prizio Construction, how would they do that?
We have a website. It's just www.prizio.com. Or, of course, they could always call here. We're in Costa Mesa, and we're not hard to find. So we're anxious to find more people who want to build buildings. Mm-hmm. So we can get back to doing what we do well.
Right. And I, again, on behalf of Doug and the, you know, the members of Executive Forums and the greater, you know, Orange County kind of listening audience and the others who listen to our shows through the various means that they're available, either live online now or as an MP3 file tomorrow and, you know, forever. I want to thank you, Dave, for taking the time to, you know, be thoughtful in your answers and to help our listening audience see these issues from your and opportunities from your perspective. And I really valued this interview and appreciate you giving us of your time. So on behalf of Critical Mass and Executive Forums, thanks.
You're welcome.
Sorry. Okay. And so that concludes the 49th interview that Doug and I have done on Critical Mass, the radio show. Tomorrow, I'll be interviewing Manuel Ramirez of Ramirez International. And the topic tomorrow is the role of a CPA and how to determine if your CPA is a good fit for your business. I encourage you to spend an hour with Manuel and with me. I feel it will be equally in content rich as the interview was here today with Dave Prizio. So on behalf of Critical Mass, the radio show, and Executive Forums Orange County, this is Rick Franzi saying I hope all the decisions that you make move your business in a positive direction.
You're listening to Critical Mass with Rick Franzi and Doug Feller, only on LA Talk Radio.